Good morning, Council, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Take your time in getting set up here. This is the second case on our calendar for today, and I apologize if I mispronounce the name of the appellant. The case is Sophia Wang Navas versus State of Minnesota. The case number is A230121. And just a few guidelines as you continue to get ready here. You can make your arguments from the lectern in the center of the room. There's a clock in the center on that lectern that will be counting down your time. So be mindful of your time, and the time is 15 minutes for appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, and then appellant will have an opportunity for a five-minute rebuttal. Before you begin your arguments, which are being recorded today, it would be very helpful if you would please identify yourself and the party you're representing. You both look ready, and so I will turn things over to our attorneys, counsel for appellant. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Ms. Navas, who will be listening to this later. My name is Beau McGraw, and I represent the appellant in these proceedings, Sophia Wang Navas. As I start out, I know that we all bring different backgrounds to this hearing this morning, and I can fully appreciate that. Some of us did civil work, some do criminal work, some did appellate work, but we've all counseled clients. We've all been entrusted under the law to bring facts and law together. I want us, as we start, and I promise to be brief, let's imagine a situation here. Let's imagine a situation where we have a client that doesn't make it her primary language, the language of the attorney, which is English. She speaks another language. Now, let's imagine she hires you for a criminal case. You're required to bring those facts and law together to counsel her. And you find out that she's charged with a complex crime whereby it's alleged she conspired with other individuals that speak her language, not yours. Let's imagine just a little bit further if we can. Let's imagine that the facts, you know the law because you're the lawyer, even though the racketeering charge at that time was fairly new in the state of Minnesota, you're aware of the law, and now it's your job to figure out the facts. You find out during the course of your representation that the facts that you are entrusted to combine with the law are in another language you don't speak, but they're there. They're there, and they are written in that language you don't speak. Now, let's assume for a minute you proceed through the proceedings. You go through the pretrial stage. We're 7 days before trial, yet there's no evidence that you hired a translator to look at those messages to determine what they say and translate them from Mandarin to English. And yet, you're providing advice to counsel your client about whether or not the facts fit the law and whether or not she should plead guilty. The client, no criminal history, thinks the lawyer knows the facts and the law. We assume these things. She knows the facts. She's on those messages. I liken it to a puzzle. If we had the puzzle pieces just spread out everywhere and we didn't have the picture of the puzzle, the client sees the puzzle pieces. The lawyer has to provide the picture. This client, proceeding to pretrial, based upon the advice of counsel, decides to enter a plea of guilty. The client pleads guilty to count one and count two of the complaint, the most serious charges in the complaint, both of which relate to her conduct associated with other individuals that didn't speak the language of the lawyer, spoke the language of the client. The lawyer articulates at the plea hearing that this isn't so much a case of whodunit, it's more of a case of culpability. Yet, at the time of the plea hearing, there's no evidence that the lawyer understood how those facts of the co-conspirators fit into the conduct of your client. Client relies. Client goes forward, pleads guilty, believing there's going to be some elaborate discussion about how her culpability fits into the crime, how the facts fit the law. We now proceed to sentencing. As we proceed to sentencing, there's some materials that are submitted to the court, none of which are transcriptions. There's motions that are filed with the court, none of which contain transcriptions. There's a meeting between an attorney and client prior to entering the courtroom at the time of sentencing. Transcriptions are not provided. And then the lawyer walks into the courtroom and starts making arguments that aren't contained in his brief about culpability and how the individual's conduct does not fit the conduct of the other co-conspirators. Starts citing to specific information that was provided in the discovery that was provided in Mandarin. Doesn't give the prosecution any notice beforehand. The judge, concerned, a very seasoned jurist at this point, about, she might have been retiring that year, it was shortly after, if she wasn't, I'm very familiar with her. She's concerned. What does she say to the counsel? She says, did you provide the transcription to the state? He says, no, I don't have a written transcription. He says, well, who transcribed it? He's on the day of sentencing. He's an officer of the court. Before the judge that's about to sentence his client, he cannot give the name of the individual that transcribed these very important messages that are Mandarin that he does not have the ability to transcribe.
Mr. McGraw, We're here because you filed a motion to withdraw your client's plea upon the remand for resentencing. And I'm wondering whether you requested an evidentiary hearing on your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel along with that motion.
We did, Your Honor. I filed a standard petition that I do in these cases along with a motion. And in those materials, we laid out the predicate facts, we provided the transcriptions that I'm relying upon, and we made all the arguments in our memorandum and asked that we be allowed to have an evidentiary hearing. The court held a kind of pre-hearing type conference, which was somewhat unique. I'm seeing that more now. And at that time, the court, again, it was the request was made for an evidentiary hearing. And one was never settled and set and said, we got this order that denied her petition for post-conviction relief, essentially her petition to withdraw her plea. The example that I gave...
Challenging the denial of an evidentiary hearing for the purpose of supplementing the record that exists?
That's exactly what we're challenging. The reason we asked for a hearing is because it's been my experience in these type of cases that if there's evidence that's provided that would support the necessity of a hearing, which we have in this case, we have evidence, first of all, we hired a translator, went through all of these items that were so important to my client's culpability and her guilt. We provided that to the court. That translator is prepared to appear at the hearing. Miss Sophia Wong Navis is prepared to appear at the hearing. She's prepared to testify about her relationship with her attorney. And she's prepared to talk about both that pretrial phase that I laid out. This wasn't some mythical example to her. She lived it. She will testify that she never received transcriptions from her attorney, that she never had an opportunity to go through these items with her attorney, other than I think what she's going to testify to is when her attorney showed up unprepared at the time of sentencing as it related to this issue of culpability. She's going to testify, I believe, that she was the person in her orange jumpsuit in a holding cell prior to going into the most important day of her life that was required to tell her attorney what was contained in those WhatsApp transcriptions. He didn't identify who translated it. I suspect that was her.
Mr. McGraw, are you alleging that district court counsel was ineffective at the time of the plea or at the time of the sentencing?
I'm alleging that he was ineffective in both areas. The reason I spent
so much... The post-conviction court understood your claim, I think, to relate only to the sentencing hearing. I think that you were alleging that district court counsel was ineffective at the time of sentencing.
I think you're right, Your Honor, and respectfully to that judge. I think that she focused probably too much on the sentencing piece and wasn't able to connect back to the withdrawal of the plea, which was our primary request, and that maybe was my fault through the briefing. I don't know. I thought I was fairly clear on that. But the reason I focused so much on the sentencing is because that is the first example that we have. We can't get in the conference room with my client where she's being counseled.
Let me go back to okay. Because, I mean, I think the district, one of the reasons why the district court denied relief is stated on page 13 of the district court's order, which is basically that plea withdrawal is not a proper remedy, even if there was proof that counsel was ineffective at the time of sentencing. The remedy for that would be a new sentencing hearing. But I don't think you addressed that in your appellate brief. Maybe I missed it. But isn't that? I mean, if your claim is ineffectiveness at the time of sentencing, would you agree with the district court on that?
I don't. Respectfully, I don't. Here's why. We don't get into the conference room at this point where my client was counseling his client, or in this case, a holding cell, about whether or not the facts fit the law and she should enter a plea of guilty, and the focus should yet be later on sentencing as it relates to culpability. We don't get that. That's not recorded. That's not transcribed. So I focus on the sentencing hearing because it is so clear to me at the sentencing hearing that the attorney's conduct fell below the objective standard of care. This judge was really troubled. So we have a chance objectively to look at the level of care that was exhibited by the attorney at the sentencing hearing. I don't get that in the conference room. But there's some connective tissue there, Your Honor.
But then isn't the appropriate procedural mechanism to file a petition for post-conviction relief to ask for resentencing and not to ask for withdrawal of the plea?
I think that's an option that would be available to my client going forward. I think 2703 allows for a motion on resentencing to be brought at any time. That's my understanding of the rules. She could do that at any time. I don't think that that's the appropriate remedy here. This goes beyond that. The idea that we would think it's justice in our system of justice that an individual that doesn't speak the language of the lawyer is alleged to have conspired with other individuals that don't speak the language of the lawyer, and then the lawyer would never produce evidence that he went through those facts, which are so principal to the underlying elements of the crime, that's not acceptable. That's not what the Sixth Amendment and 14th Amendment call for. This requires something more. And so to
Mr.
answer,
McGraw,
if I could just finish this point, just, I promise I'm going to be brief. But I have a lot of passion for this. I cannot, the reason that I feel so strongly is because she relied upon this lawyer to enter this plea. And this lawyer, there's no evidence. Now, if the lawyer, that's why we have post-conviction relief evidentiary hearings. Maybe the lawyer comes in and produces transcriptions like I did. Okay? Then the case looks different. But we didn't have that because the judge, the district court, shut the process down short. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you or your client submit any affidavits with the petition?
We did submit an affidavit with the petition. We submitted an affidavit with the petition from a co-conspirator, an individual that
I saw that one. What about your client? Did she make any statements in an affidavit form about her state of mind at the time of the plea or why she pleaded guilty?
I don't know right now, Your Honor. I don't have that in front of me. I'm not sure if it was that. I'm not sure. That's the best answer I have.
Are there any allegations in the petition that allude to that issue?
I believe so. I believe we read out, I mean, the largest part of our memorandum, the largest part of our petition went into the elements of when it's appropriate to withdraw a plea. We talked about whether the plea is accurate. We talked about whether the plea is voluntary.
I'm referring to the factual, whether there's factual allegations in the petition or factual statements in an affidavit about that kind of go directly to the heart of the plea.
Not in an, I don't know in an affidavit as I sit here today. I believe we argued all of those in a memorandum, and we focused a lot of our argument on the issue of intelligence and whether or not an individual can enter an intelligent and knowing plea when the attorney who was entrusted with combining the facts and law didn't do the work to go through the discovery.
So the evidentiary record that you're relying on, it sounds like it's really kind of the record of the sentencing proceeding.
That and the plea? That in the plea, Your Honor?
Plea colloquy as well.
Yeah, so in the plea, and I think the connective tissue, and I want to just touch on this briefly, the connective tissue between the plea and the sentencing hearing are these statements by the lawyer, where the lawyer is kind of counseling the client on the record, if you will, that we are going to show up at sentencing, we're going to first deal with the racketeering issue, because the racketeering issue required a very in-depth look in the connection between the co-conspirators, okay? So we're going to focus on that. That requires the evidence that I've been talking about all morning. And the other thing that, which I think is really important, that the attorney talked about on the plea was that we're going to be bringing motions both for a dispositional and or a durational departure. And he led his client to believe at that hearing that he had gone through this evidence. And in fact, later we found out that he hadn't. She relied upon that. She thought she was entering a knowingly and intelligent plea. It's clear from the evidence, both at the plea hearing, both at the sentencing, that she did not. I just want to, just one part here, right? A couple things. I want to read this. This was available to the attorney at the time. Now keep in mind, actually, I'm going to run out of time. I should, unless the court will let me borrow a minute or two from my...
No.
Can't do that? Okay, I'll come back. Thank you.
All right, we'll see you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alexandra Meyer, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. I will note that I'm a Ramsey, assistant Ramsey County attorney. This case was prosecuted jointly by both Ramsey and Washington counties. Trial counsel's alleged failure to translate hundreds of WeChat messages between four co-defendants involved in running a large-scale sex trafficking organization does not demonstrate counsel was ineffective so as to justify plea withdrawal in this case. As Judge Freeman properly ruled, appellant's claim that trial counsel was ineffective fails for any or all of three reasons. Firstly, under the second Strickland prong, the outcome of either the plea hearing or the sentencing hearing would not have been different but for the absence of the translated messages. Turning first to the sentencing hearing, counsel made arguments about these messages in his sentencing memorandum. He referred to the communications between the co-defendants and obviously knew what those messages contained. He was able to get many, if not all of the messages into the record in front of the judge before the state objected and before the court eventually sustained the objection and said that's enough. If the state
So they were not introduced into evidence.
They were not, but the court did make note, saying, I note there's a dispute here, which is, and she additionally noted that she didn't believe that these messages would have been admissible at trial.
You say they were in the record. They were in the record as evidence that was offered, but excluded, correct?
They were in the record as argument, not as evidence. I guess that would be the appropriate way to say that. But if they had appropriately been in the record and the state had been aware of them, the state would have certainly countered them with evidence of their own, and that is reflected in the sentencing transcript at page 13 and again at page 19, where the state talks about how prepared they were for trial, the fact that because this plea happened essentially on the eve of trial, they had done extensive preparation. They had ledgers and ledgers, as they referred to them, of the administrative subpoenas. They had counsel even said that they specifically had evidence that they would have introduced to counter these claims. So Judge Freeman found it reasonable that counsel knew that if he had presented these translated text messages as exhibits prior to the hearing, that the state would have responded and would have destroyed his argument. So it could have been strategic going to the first Strickland prong. But additionally, Judge Miles understood the argument that counsel was making. She understood it completely. She had presided over the plea hearings of all three other co-defendants. She'd presided over a pretrial hearing where they talked about Ms. Navas's police interview. She had read the transcript of that interview. She understood the parameters of this case, and she understood exactly what this defendant pled guilty to. And she said she took note of the dispute, but found that Ms. Navas's conduct was easily equivalent to that of Ms. Jing, who had also been assigned a severity level 9 and pled guilty to what essentially was the top of the box without the aggravating factor, which differentiated the two parties. As for the plea hearing, the outcome would not have been different but for this promise of messages either. Appellant told the court that she pled guilty because she was afraid of the 30-year sentence the prosecutor was kind of hinting that he'd be seeking. And in context, when you read the portion of the plea transcript at page 28, where counsel supposedly promised to prepare and present these transcripts, in fact, what the court was referring to was how difficult it would be for her to agree to probation on this case. And she said, "Do you understand that?" And counsel interjected and said, "Ms. Navas, you and I have talked about how we're going to prepare to argue about basically your situation for a downward dispositional departure," not talking about where these text messages could have possibly been used, which would have been to go to the nature of the offense itself, which would be the downward durational departure. But when you look at the actual, what the attorney said on the record at page 28, that is exactly what he was talking about, was that he was going to submit these three exhibits, which he did in fact submit, one involving her health, one involving letters from the people who worked for her saying that she was important in their community, and I don't remember what the third one is off the top of my head, but three exhibits that all went to why she should be given a dispositional departure.
Ms. Meyer, what's your understanding of the claim? Is it a claim of ineffectiveness at the time of the plea or at the time of sentencing or both?
I believe it is at the time of sentencing, because prior to that, this attorney worked incredibly hard for this client. There were substantial motions. There was preparation. There was an intensive sentencing argument. Judge Freeman noted that it was zealous representation, all the things that an attorney should do, and the only even possible alleged failure is not having submitted pre-translated messages. And additionally, the attorney knew of these messages, used them. He stated on the record, "We have reviewed the audio messages in Chinese." He just didn't prepare these transcripts. And as the court noted, the state could have countered by preparing their own, which potentially would have disagreed with what the actual translation said, or would have provided more context.
Just to be clear, I guess I'm not asking whether district court counsel was ineffective at the time of the plea, but I'm asking about what is the scope of the post-conviction claim. I think the post-conviction court understood it to be an allegation that district court counsel was ineffective at sentencing and only at sentencing. Is that your understanding too, a minute ago you made reference to, I think the outcome of the plea hearing would not have been different, but that seems to suggest that maybe the post-conviction claim is broader than what the post-conviction court understood.
That was merely in response to Mr. McGraw's position that the ineffectiveness claim was raised as to the plea hearing. My understanding is that it was ineffectiveness as to sentencing.
It's not really a post-conviction either, though, right? I mean, this was raised as a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. So what's your view of the sort of lens that we should be reviewing this with? Are we looking at this as a motion to withdraw with, you know, no evidentiary record? Or are we looking at this as a post-conviction challenge to a conviction and sentence where Mr. McGraw says an evidentiary hearing was denied?
I may be incorrect, but I don't believe an evidentiary hearing was ever requested. That's my understanding of the record, that in essence, a hearing took place because the resentencing had to take place. And at the same time, having received this petition, the court heard from the parties, and I appeared at that hearing. And there was no, to my recollection, there was no argument that there should be a further evidentiary hearing with testimony.
That's how I look at the motion as well. I don't see a request for like your typical post-conviction evidentiary hearing. So are we reviewing this as a denial of a motion to withdraw a plea instead of a post-conviction?
Well, counsel has never argued that in his briefing. Today would be the first time he argued that, and I would submit that he has waived that argument.
Which argument?
The argument that he should have had an evidentiary hearing. I believe he has not raised that appropriately before this court, so this court should not rule on whether or not the district court properly or improperly denied such a hearing. I don't believe it was requested, and I don't believe it was briefed here.
So, counsel, my understanding of the district court order is that in the James v. State case from 2005, the Minnesota Supreme Court said that when the district court gets a Rule 15 motion post-conviction, that they need to construe it as a post-conviction petition. And I guess the question that I have is when a district court decides, or I mean essentially is required by the Minnesota Supreme Court to convert a Rule 15 motion into a post-conviction petition, whether that in and of itself requires the district court to consider whether an evidentiary hearing is needed.
I'm not aware of any case law or any rule that obligates the district court to consider that, especially not where it wasn't raised by the parties. You are correct. The rule is clear that a motion to withdraw a plea raised after sentencing is treated as a post-conviction petition, so I would assume all the standard post-conviction rules apply. But that certainly wasn't how this was argued below or how it was raised.
Well, I guess I'll speak for myself. I do think that the evidentiary hearing issue, just when you're reading the district court's order, it, especially on the first Strickland prong, feels like the district court is making a lot of findings without actually having the attorney present to testify as to what tactical or non-tactical decisions that they were making at the sentencing hearing. And would you agree that if we needed to decide this on the first Strickland prong, that some kind of evidentiary hearing would be needed?
You potentially could decide that, but in order to prevail, appellant has to meet both Strickland prongs, and clearly they cannot meet the second prong, and the district court found that counsel did not meet the second prong. So it seems not an appropriate use of the court's resources, if that's a way you want to look at it. But it certainly doesn't seem like it is needed where, as I said at the beginning, there are three reasons the judge denied this, and any of those reasons are sufficient for this court to affirm the ruling below.
Well, and Ms. Navis never asked to call her trial attorney to make a record in this case, did she?
No, as far as I know, there was no witness list filed. There, as you pointed out, and I will confirm, there was no affidavit from Ms. Navis. There was an affidavit from an interpreter and a co-defendant that were submitted along with some translated messages, none of which, I will point out, had anything to do with her innocence. They did not exonerate her. They weren't newly discovered. They had, the only thing they had to do was with culpability. And as Judge Miles noted, culpability and responsibility are not the same thing. And she talked about when she was sentencing that she had spent the last hour and a half hearing about arguments about whether or not this defendant, what role exactly she played in the organization. And she said, on the record, it doesn't matter to me. That's not what this sentence is about. This sentence is about thousands of Backpage.com advertisements. This sentence is about 7 phone lines being answered every day with 12 to 18 sex trafficking victims that this defendant admitted to, and the record supports her doing that, which meets the definition of the counts that she pled to, and she entered a guilty plea admitting to those facts. So whether or not she was number 3 on the hierarchy or number 1 or number 6, none of that has to do with the sentence that was imposed, nor would that sentence have changed if these translated chat messages could have been introduced or were introduced. And if they had been, the state certainly would have countered them.
Ms. Meyer, at the beginning of your argument, you alluded to 3 reasons to affirm, but I don't think you actually listed all of them. You began talking about the first, but to give us that overview, could you tell us quickly what are the second and third?
So the first was the second Strickland prong. The first would be the 2 reasons that Judge Freeman found for not meeting the first Strickland prong, which was that it was trial strategy, which again refers to the fact that the state could and would have countered this and made a record that they would have been able to counter this. Or in the alternative, she found that it was in fact a reasonable trial strategy under the charges in this case that there would not have been a reason to translate these messages prior to trial or even prior to sentencing, because the plea did not involve whether or not Ms. Navas was, quote, the boss of this organization. And as I pointed out in my brief, the only time during her plea hearing that the word boss came up was when she testified that Mr. Zhang was the boss. And so under either two alternative theories of the first Strickland prong or the second Strickland prong, what Judge Freeman found in finding that what Judge Miles did in sentencing was completely appropriate under these circumstances. And I would make one further point.
And then the third one, the third reason?
The law of the case, Your Honor. This court, different presiding judges, but this court dealt with whether or not this was an appropriate sentence based on the relative culpability of, or the relative participation of the co-defendants on direct appeal. And this court found that it was not an unreasonable sentence, that the judge did not abuse her discretion. And that would be a further reason to find that this matter is not appropriate for a remand.
Did Judge Freeman use that reasoning?
No. If the court
So the translated chat messages, I mean, counsel at sentencing was unsuccessful in getting that admitted into evidence, right?
He was, if I may
you may
answer. He was not unsuccessful about talking about them and raising the issue. He was unsuccessful in submitting them as exhibits to the court.
I mean, for reasons that I think the way I read the record, he was unsuccessful by a long shot. The district court thought it was an unreasonable way to try to present evidence. But anyway, I question whether that sort of last minute preparation of evidence without ever, you know, translations obviously are subject to challenge by opposing party. I question whether that is reasonable performance of the lawyer's duties, or at least whether it's advantageous, whether there's a strategically advantageous reason to do it that way. Can you explain that further? Help me understand why the post-conviction court found in your favor on that issue.
I believe because having read the chat messages that were submitted as an exhibit, the district court could see that there was nothing of terrible substance there. There was only contested issues about co-defendants blaming other co-defendants.
But the district court wasn't permitted to read them for evidentiary value as substantive evidence because they were not admitted. The district court made an evidentiary ruling that they were, she sustained the objection, so they were never in evidence.
Well, and she also said that the approach, she didn't appreciate the approach, which was that he was, as she said, down in the bottom of the pond, not even in the weeds, and she was looking at the macro view of this large-scale organization. So that I believe if she thought they had any relevance, as a good judge, she would have felt the need to act in the interest of justice. But here she termed it a violation of the Miles no ambush rule, meaning she thought this was a strategic attempt by the attorney to get around having to go through the challenge that the state would have brought.
Thanks.
I hope that answered your question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's what Judge Miles said exactly. Then how did you get them translated, Mr. Hawkins? Through an individual that speaks Chinese, Your Honor. The court. An unnamed individual? Question. Mr. Hawkins. Yes, Your Honor. The court. Now, yes, Your Honor. The judge says, I think it's time for a break. Here's one of the transcriptions that should have been before the court.
So, Mr. McGraw, I think your challenge is to move from the first Strickland prong to the second and try to show how it would have made a difference if counsel would have done something differently at that time.
Yeah, but I don't think there's any evidence the counsel did something that's so basic to a representation of a client in this case. When you have this evidence, which is the most important part of evidence as it relates to the conspiratorial nature of the two charges, it required the due diligence to be exercised by the attorney to have hired somebody that could have read, could have transcribed that evidence to him, gone through that evidence with his client, counseled his client appropriately. There's no evidence that that existed. And the evidence, the sentencing hearing wasn't as streamlined as whether or not we're doing a durational departure or a dispositional departure. We all know what those hearings look like. The court had to make a determination how Ms. Wong Novice's culpability fit in with the other defendants. So it required the court to have that hood lifted on the communications between the parties. And if it would have happened, if I could just read this at 1 second here, and this is found on page 18 of my brief. This is something that we transcribed. This is from the individual that we think was truly in charge of the operation. He's identified as Mark. And he's speaking to the other co-conspirator, not my client, Jiang. It says this. It's found on page 18, three-quarters of the page down, three-quarters of the way down the page. We made over 10,000. Again, my transcription, I have the Mandarin and the English. We made over 10,000 already. That, of course, includes Fargo and then the hotel rooms and other stupid stuff. Deduct all the expenses over $10,000. Sophia don't know how much we need to pay her for answering the phone. Have not summarized her number yet. Probably it is about $1,000. Then we have $9,000 left this month, this week, and we can each get over $4,000 next Monday. So you got like a balance sheet discussion going on here between two co-conspirators and my client's position throughout her sentencing proceeding and prior to that time that she was culpable, but not on their level. And this court, under the racketeering statute, had it as a part of the sentencing process to determine her level of culpability. The lawyer didn't submit this evidence because the lawyer, based upon the record that I have, didn't do the work that was necessary to understand that that evidence existed and combine that with the law to advocate effectively for this client.
But again, counsel, that goes to the sentencing hearing and not to the validity of the plea. Correct? I mean, you're not arguing that she was not, that she didn't admit enough facts to show that she was guilty of this crime. And I think looking at the plea hearing transcript, I think she also was made abundantly aware by the district court of what the consequences of that plea were in terms of that she could get a 150-month sentence to probation. And I think the district court did some pretty clear signaling in terms of the judge's inclinations in terms of sentencing. And so I'm still having trouble connecting the dots to how you get from what happened at the sentencing hearing to how you support the claim that you made at post-conviction, which is she didn't make an intelligent plea and she was provided ineffective assistance of counsel when she pled guilty.
If this plea is allowed to stand, we're setting the precedent that an individual can plead guilty without receiving assistance of counsel as it relates to going through discovery that on the case. And that's what this is. There's no evidence that he went through this discovery with her. That goes right to the plea, the intelligent nature of the plea.
Mr. McGraw, we don't have a record in order to make that determination. And looking at your motion to withdraw the plea, I don't see a request for an evidentiary hearing, you know, for the purpose of calling counsel to make that record.
The court has that ability. I mean, so if...
So sua sponte, like the court should have done it on its own?
If the court's going to make factual findings about the trial attorney's conduct as it relates to whether or not it's reasonable, sure, the court has the ability to do that. If we would have filed this motion a day after the two-year statute of limitations, I'll guarantee you the state would have said it's a post-conviction relief motion. And on a post-conviction relief motion, rather than a withdrawal of the plea motion, that's exactly what is anticipated, that the court would determine whether or not there's sufficient facts to warrant additional evidentiary hearings. And in this case, everybody would have benefited from that, but most notably my client, because this was not fair. This is not consistent with the Constitution.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning, and the case is now submitted to us. We'll be issuing our decision within the next 90 days.